Pain has reached epidemic proportions in America. I'm Dr. Paul Christo. This is Aches and Gains.
Dr. Paul Christo is one of America's leading experts on relieving pain. He's board certified, Harvard trained, and a pain medicine specialist at Johns Hopkins. U.S. News and World Report ranks him as a top doctor and among the top 1% in the nation for pain management. Older adults, children, and even infants struggle to cope with pain. But there's hope, and there are treatments that can ease pain and suffering. The show offers compelling stories about people who found relief. We share cutting-edge treatments from contributing experts, and we offer ways to help people cope with their pain.
Welcome to the show. Leukemia is a medical term for cancer of the blood cells. We're going to talk about acute myeloid leukemia, known as AML, the most common acute leukemia in adults. It arises from genetic mutations in precursor cells, known as myeloid cells, located in the bone marrow. These mutations interfere with the production of normal blood cells that help us clot, fight infection, or carry oxygen to tissues. Symptoms of leukemia can be nonspecific, but typically patients experience fatigue, weakness, bleeding, or infection. AML is rapidly lethal if untreated, but overall survival has improved for those under age 65 from just 8 months in the 1970s to 46 months in 2014. Although survival for those over 65 hasn't improved as substantially, precision oncology is helping to tailor treatments based on genetic and chromosomal testing. On today's show, we'll have the opportunity to hear from Dr. Mark Levis. He's a professor of oncology and director of the Acute Leukemia Service at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. He'll share the standard therapies that are used for AML, as well as novel targeted therapies that are prolonging life.
Aches and Gains is supported by the Institute for Continued Healthcare Education, Daiichi Sankyo, and Kowa Pharmaceuticals.
Dr. Mark Levis is co-director of the Division of Hematologic Malignancies. He's an expert in acute myeloid leukemia and other leukemias, while his research centers on developing novel targeted therapies. Dr. Levis, welcome to Aches and Gains.
Thank you.
On our last show, we covered risks associated with AML, symptoms of AML, and diagnostic testing, including the presence of the FLT3 gene mutation. Dr. Levis, let me dig into this FLT3 receptor mutation a bit more. There's evidence that a FLT3 internal tandem duplication mutation, ITD, is a driver mutation that leads to a high leukemic burden, poor prognosis, and negatively impacts the management of AML. Could you help us understand why this ITD mutation is so detrimental?
There's different ways to turn the receptor on by mutation. The ITD mutation is a particularly nefarious one that not only turns the FLT3 receptor permanently on, it makes its signal even hotter, if you will.
Okay.
So it actually mutates the sucker. So not only is it on, it's on in overdrive. And so it really stimulates the growth. And when these cells are growing so fast, they also tend to ignore chemo. This was a terrible prognosis disease until we developed FLT3 inhibitors. And then all of a sudden, it becomes easy to fix.
Indeed. And we're going to talk specifically about what those FLT3 inhibitors are. Mark, what's the prognosis like for a patient with genetic FLT3, that is FLT3 ITD mutations?
Unfortunately, AML is not a disease that should be treated in the community. Mm-hmm. So yes, somebody's coming to a major leukemia center that can recognize this disease. If it's a patient under age, 65, 70, we're curing the majority of these patients.
Wow.
In some cases, we are doing them this with stem cell or bone marrow transplant much of the time. But even in patients that don't have the option or ability to have a transplant for a variety of reasons, I've got patients in remission for years that I'm just maintaining them and watching them close with these FLT3 inhibitors and with the ability to monitor the disease at a very sensitive level, so I can spot that monster if it tries to come back.
Well, excellent. Dr. Levis, a cancer diagnosis often leads patients to wonder whether the cancer or even the treatments will be painful. What do you tell patients with newly diagnosed AML?
Very occasionally, I will get a patient whose AML is an angry, painful one. It makes the bones swell and hurt. Those are rare. Most of the time, when somebody is terminal with AML, they say, how am I going to die? What's going to happen to me? And most of the time, they're just tired, and they just want to go to sleep. So I suppose that is, you know, one of the nicer things about the cancer, is it is not a particularly painful one, usually. That doesn't make it pleasant, but there is that, I guess.
Many would be glad to hear that it's not painful. Let's now drill down into the treatment paradigms. These focus on the treatment of the primary cancer, as well as supportive care measures. If we look at the therapies available or in development that target pathways in AML, we can see extraordinary progress and opportunity for patients with AML. Now, let's start with induction therapy, also known as cytotoxic chemotherapy. What is that?
We're going to induce a remission. Okay, so the patient comes in and their bone marrow is packed full of these blasts, and their healthy stem cells cannot make red blood cells, platelets, or healthy white blood cells. So they're infected, they're anemic, they're tired, and just feel in general awful and in danger of dying.
Mm-hmm.
So we bring them into a specialized leukemia ward. Our rooms are kind of like a bubble, if you will, to protect the patient from, you know, outside infections. The patient's usually on antibiotics, broad spectrum, to keep infections away. And then we start the actual chemo. If they are up to age 65 or 70, we will start fairly intensive chemotherapy. It drips in over the course of a week. Well, there's lots of different chemotherapy regimens that work. They are designed, it's, as they say, almost like napalm, to kill off everything in the marrow and hope that the healthy cells grow back, which usually happens. Now, if somebody is less fit, more, it used to be a terrible thing. We didn't have anything that worked. But about 10 years ago, we started working on a pill that inhibits a cancer protein called BCL2, and the drug is called venetoclax. And that's really made a huge change in the field, because combining it with a very low dose of chemotherapy can get you almost the same effects, except you don't have any of the side effects of the intensive chemotherapy. The intensive chemotherapy can damage the healthy cells of your body,
mm-hmm.
damages the lining of the gut and makes your mouth sore and gives you abdominal pain or diarrhea, causes skin rash. This newer therapy, and we call it Aza-Ven, azacitidine is the chemo and venetoclax is the pill. You can literally do it as an outpatient practically, and it will gently kill off the blast. But does it do it as effectively as the intensive stuff? Not quite. Much gentler. So the patient, you know, if they're not particularly sick from their leukemia, and sometimes they're not, they're like reading a book, watching TV
mm-hmm.
for the 3 weeks in the hospital. I'm not kidding. They're like, why are you here? They can come in sick with infections and bleeding and so forth, and then they're going to be sick. The chemo doesn't make them sick. So those are the two broad recipes that we use to induce a remission, where you kill off all the children of the bad stem cell, the leukemia cell, and let the healthy stuff grow back. That process takes anywhere from 4 to 8 weeks to where the patient is feeling normal again. And then you proceed to what we call or consolidate that remission with further therapy and or a stem cell transplant.
Okay, I mean, excellent description. For decades, the standard treatment for AML was a medication called cytarabine along with an IV anthracycline. Could you describe those for us?
Yeah, we call that 7+3. So the cytarabine is a chemotherapy that drips in 24 hours a day for 7 straight days.
Mm-hmm.
And we augment that with 3 pushes, you know, day 1, day 2, day 3 of this thing called an anthracycline, idarubicin or doxorubicin or daunorubicin. The patients call it Red Devil. It makes them pee orange, but it adds a lot of side effects, what we call the mucositis, the pain in the mouth when you're swallowing, or the abdominal pain. The cytarabine causes rash and fevers. It's not very pleasant.
Mm.
7+3 was invented 50 years ago.
Wow.
We're finally phasing it out, or certainly changing it by adding targeted drugs to it and make it work better.
Let me give you a moment to think about all that information while we take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about these targeted therapies. I'm Dr. Paul Christo, and you're listening to Aches and Gains.
Aches and Gains is supported by the Institute for Continued Healthcare Education and by an educational grant from Daiichi Sankyo. To access podcasts of the show, please go to paulchristomd.com. That's paulchristomd.com.
Welcome back. We're here with Dr. Mark Levis. He's a hematologist, oncologist, and expert in acute myeloid leukemia. Dr. Levis, if patients have AML with a mutated FLT3, do you then add intravenous cytarabine along with an IV anthracycline, like you just mentioned, and to that add either targeted therapy called midostaurin or quizartinib.
So yes, provided they are young and fit enough to tolerate 7+3. Midostaurin is the older FLT3 inhibitor. There's a new one, quizartinib, which is now replacing midostaurin. It's a better tolerated one. However, what do you do for somebody who cannot tolerate the 7+3? And in the studies, nobody over age 60 benefited because the chemo was too intense. So you give them azaven, which is the gentler induction, but that's not addressing the FLT3 mutation. Now, I know what we do here at Hopkins. Mm-hmm. We will put them in remission with azaven and then switch to a FLT3 inhibitor-based therapy. But the world has not yet settled on an exact recipe for how to address the issue in the older FLT3 mutant patient.
Right. Now, let me ask you about midostaurin. What is this targeted therapy doing to counteract the harmful effects of the FLT3 mutation?
The FLT3 mutation, it's occurring in this receptor that is trying to tell the cell to grow. And so the mutation has forced it into the on position. And the way it tells a cell to grow is there's something called an active site. I call it the mouth of the enzyme. Midostaurin just binds to the mouth and, you know, jams it. It doesn't do it in a very elegant fashion, and unfortunately it sticks in the mouth of a lot of other enzymes that kind of look like FLT3. Quizartinib is highly selective for FLT3 and pretty much only sticks in FLT3's mouth, so it doesn't cause anywhere near the side effects and is more effective at turning the FLT3 enzyme off.
Whereas midostaurin then can be used for any FLT3 mutation.
Correct. Midostaurin works on all of them. Quizartinib only works on the ITD, the scary one. Mm-hmm. There's another drug called gilteritinib, which is approved, which we use quite a lot here as well, that also works for both of them like midostaurin, but it is much more effective than midostaurin. Midostaurin is really a very old drug, and I think it's being really phased out.
Well, when I reviewed the studies on midostaurin, the studies do show superior overall survival and event-free survival. And speaking of quizartinib, the FDA has approved quizartinib to treat adults with recently diagnosed FLT3 ITD, that is internal tandem duplication positive mutation. And I believe it's used for induction therapy, which is what we've been talking about, consolidation therapy, and then maintenance therapy. Dr. Levis, tell us more about quizartinib.
It binds near the active site. It actually binds to the receptor and forces it closed to just kind of shut down. It is very different than midostaurin, much more selective, designed. Midostaurin was found almost by chance. It was this weird poison that was isolated from the slimy bacteria on a rock. Oh, look, this inhibits lots of things, including FLT3. Whereas quizartinib was really the first designer drug for this disease. In fact, it was identified 20 years ago in a lab looking for inhibitors of FLT3. Mm-hmm. It just took a long time to get through the regulatory process and get approved.
Now, both midostaurin and quizartinib are given orally. That is, it's a pill. What are the typical side effects of quizartinib?
Doesn't really cause much in the way of side effects. Is extremely safe. I've used it for years. Patients usually don't even know they're getting it. Whereas midostaurin is a rather unpleasant drug. It smells like skunk weed, in fact. It's very, very distinct. You've never smelled a pill that smelled bad. Mm-hmm. Well, we got one for you. That's midostaurin.
Okay, could you talk to us about the boxed warning for this particular medication and specifically related to possible heart conduction problems?
Yes, it causes what we call QT prolongation, which is easy to monitor for. And that really is why it took so long to get the drug approved. The FDA was sort of gasping and clutching its pearls about, oh, this is unsafe. Yes, I know, this is a dangerous disease. So it was a little bit frustrating to the oncology community watching them do this. And so they put these scary boxed warnings, this could kill you. Yeah, try FLT3 ITD AML if you want something that could kill you.
Indeed. Then do you need to get an EKG before you start therapy?
Oh, yes, that's a requirement.
Now, Mark, let me ask you about how both of these drugs, midostaurin and quizartinib, have improved outcomes. For example, the trial data on quizartinib indicated that the duration of complete remission was more than 3 times longer in those receiving the drug.
Yes. Well, you remember the trial to do that is a placebo-controlled trial. So those heroic patients who participated in that trial got chemotherapy alone with just placebo, not a FLT3 inhibitor. And I've already told you that doesn't work very well.
Yeah.
I mean, the same thing occurred with midostaurin. So the results of any FLT3 inhibitor in that circumstance look very good.
That's right. With quizartinib, Can this medication be given during all three phases of treatment? That is induction, which we've been talking about, and then consolidation and maintenance, which we will subsequently talk about.
That's exactly how we do it. In fact, if you stop giving the FLT3 inhibitor, that little sucker will regrow. Mm-hmm. You got to keep your thumbs on it the whole time with a FLT3 inhibitor. Question is, when a patient's in remission and if they're 2 or 3 years out, are they cured? Do you know if they're cured? Can you stop the FLT3 inhibitor? So this was always a problem. We would stop it in some patients and they would be fine. Others would relapse instantly with the FLT3 mutant leukemia. Here we developed a fairly fancy test that can detect approximately one leukemia cell in a million hiding in the bone marrow with this mutation. And we're using that test to identify those patients that need to stay on the drug and those that are essentially cured. And so this is a big change in the field that we're trying to teach the rest of the world how to use.
Yes, and I hope you're successful in doing that. Let's move on to consolidation therapy. It seems that nearly all patients with complete remission will relapse unless post-remission therapy is given.
That's correct. The bad old stem cell is hiding amongst all those healthy cells down there at one in a billion and will regrow. And you're right back with relapse. Furthermore, what relapses is usually tougher and stronger. So you have to give additional therapy to try and eradicate that residual leukemia stem cell. And that could be challenging.
I believe that. What does consolidation therapy consist of?
In some leukemias, genetically, we know that if we simply give several rounds of what's called high-dose cytarabine, which sounds scary, but in fact, done correctly, is pretty easy on the patient. Mm-hmm. You do 3 or 4 rounds of that, stretching out over that 4 to 5 month period. That's where I said, this is how I'm going to ruin the life of you for 6 months. Mm-hmm. That's consolidation chemotherapy. It only works to cure the disease a minority of the time. Only in certain subtypes genetically defined will we do that. And I do that. It's probably less than 20% of leukemia I can cure just with that. In the case of an older patient where I say, look, I'm going to give you this Aza-Ven stuff as your consolidation, and we're going to have you come in every 2 to 3 months and get another round of it in the clinic and go home. And I have patients in their 5th and 6th year on that treatment.
Wow.
Others, and this is a large fraction of patients, I basically say, we can't kill that stem cell, and I can't keep it down indefinitely. We have to switch your stem cells out with somebody else's, and that's a stem cell transplant. So your consolidation is going to be a stem cell transplant.
Well, and if you're wondering how successful consolidation therapy is, we'll find out right after the break. I'm Dr. Paul Christo, and you're listening to Aches and Gains.
Aches and Gains is supported by an educational grant from COA Pharmaceuticals America, Incorporated. For cutting-edge treatments and resources, follow Dr. Paul Christo on Twitter at Dr. Paul Christo and like Aches and Gains with Dr. Paul Christo on Facebook.
And we're back. Mark, how effective, or successful, if you will, is consolidation therapy?
It depends on the leukemia, because I told you there's some AMLs that, forget it, your consolidation isn't going to do too much good. Others, it can cure. Others, it just gets a little bit deeper remission. So we can follow the depth of remission with these tests, for example. We'll give 7+3 and quiz and see, okay, we've dropped that mutation down to 1 cell in 1,000. Now we're going to give a consolidation with quiz. Oh, look, we've dropped it down to 1 cell in 1,000,000, or we can't even detect it now. Hmm. Now let's transplant the patient. We're done. It's very few patients that go through the exact same footsteps. It's truly personalized.
And it's really highly based on genetics. The third phase of treatment is called maintenance therapy. What is that about?
Maintenance therapy came about with, like, we know you're in remission, we're scared you're going to relapse, we're going to give you some pill or some noxious substance that's supposed to keep you from relapsing. It's been very difficult to demonstrate that there is any such agent that can do that. However, we have, with FLT3 inhibitors, demonstrated that in patients who have detectable mutation before their transplant, if they go on a maintenance pill for a 2-year period, they're much, much more likely to be cured than if they don't go on that pill. Mm-hmm. This would be gilteritinib, another FLT3 inhibitor. Quizartinib does almost the same thing.
Okay. And what about oral azacitidine?
Oral azacitidine has this reputation of being maintenance therapy, but it's really not. The trial that got it approved took older patients who had induction therapy and sort of fell apart and couldn't get any more. They couldn't get consolidation. or if they did, it was only maybe one cycle. So we knew those patients were going to relapse. So they were randomized to get either nothing or this oral azacitidine, which isn't very pleasant to take. It's chemo, gives all sorts of GI side effects. Those incompletely treated patients were randomized to get additional maintenance or continuation treatment with oral azacitidine or nothing. And it turns out if you got additional treatment, you lived longer. So that's what got that drug approved. But there's a lot of confusion about really how it should be used, even amongst leukemia doctors. I don't use it much.
Overall, though, is there hope for increased survival in patients with AML?
Huge. Whenever somebody publishes a study saying, look, we've done something, and compared to 5 years ago, we have much better survival, we all laugh because survival goes up every 5 years in this field, irrespective, because we've got improved antibiotics, improved supportive care, improved bone marrow transplant techniques. We're treating older and older patients with targeted therapies. We know how to detect the mutations. The cure rates, or whatever you want to call them, long-term survival rates keep going up with this disease every five-year period. And again, it gets back to the first patient I saw as a fellow we sent off to hospice. There's no way we would have done that now. That patient would be in clinic getting one of multiple different treatments and alive.
Huge difference from hospice to remission and often to cure. You're in fact developing new therapies for AML. What are some of those therapies on the horizon?
The latest one that is going to be approved is targeting a pretty broad chunk of mutations, and they're called menin inhibitors. They're neat. They're going to make a huge impact within the next 5 years, changing survival for all manner of patients. By themselves, they won't work all that great, but when you incorporate them into our existing therapies, they're going to augment the cure rates, clearly, for an even larger chunk of patients. Probably about a third of AML they'll be applicable to. There's about seven different companies with drugs that are approaching the finish line. The FDA is going to be overwhelmed with applications for them. They are working.
Well, that's terrific news. Will they be used in all three phases of AML treatment?
We're going to be using them in induction, consolidation, and maintenance. That's kind of the paradigm. If you have a target, keep that sucker on. Now, you don't want to keep it on forever. We'll want to mix and match and use them intelligently. If we have multiple targeted agents, let's do agent A and B first, and then when the patient's in remission, we'll switch to agent C and D, and so forth. Those are studies that are ongoing. Even when the drugs are approved, that's when the real work begins. You've got this clever new toy. How do we use it best? Mm-hmm. So even with FLT3 inhibitors, even though those were approved years ago, we're still trying to figure out how best to use them and in who, how, when.
How do the menin inhibitors work?
It is inhibiting a very fundamental mechanism in gene expression that's been co-opted by the leukemia. It turns on a series of genes, including FLT3. Let's turn on a whole bunch of genes that will help me grow. And it's called the HOXA9 complex. Menin is a component of that, and if you block menin's interaction with that, you shut it off. Turns out that complex is activated in about a third of AML. And so it's going to have a huge impact in a large fraction of AML. And so we'll use it with the FLT3 inhibitors. We'll use it with the IDH inhibitors, with venetoclax.
Well, gosh, I mean, the future looks really bright. Mark, do you think we'll see therapies that prevent AML in the future?
Almost certainly. So that is obviously the holy grail. You don't want to ever want to be my patient. You want to have your primary care done a genetic screen and say, oh dear, you've got something happening here. Oh, absolutely. We're able to detect now without these bone marrow biopsies, just using snippets of DNA floating in the blood, mm-hmm. where we start picking up these things and saying, okay, there's a problem here. And so can we now use a pill to, and there are already instances where we are using some of the targeted agents early on before the patient has any disease whatsoever to prevent it from growing.
Dr. Levis, you provided outstanding information about AML and have provided a lot of hope for the future. Thank you so much for being here today.
Of course. Happy to participate.
I'm Dr. Paul Christo, and you're listening to Aches and Gains.
The views and opinions expressed in this radio program are solely the views of Dr. Paul Christo and do not necessarily express the views of this radio station and Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, nor an endorsement by any or all of them of any of its content. This show provides medical information, not advice. Please consult your personal physician before engaging in any course of treatment or use of any of the techniques or products discussed on this show. Discussion of particular uses of products on this show have not been approved by any of the manufacturers of such products. To access podcasts of the show, please go to paulchristomd.com. That's paulchristomd.com. Aches and Gains is produced by Ty Ford. Dr. Paul Christo is the executive producer. Thanks for listening. This is Aches and Gains with Dr. Paul Christo.